Hello, this is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest in With Respect is a special guest. He was with us 16 years ago when this program first started on WRHC radio down in Three Oaks, Michigan. And he, John Vickers, he was the guiding light, the founder of our radio station there. And it was one of our great disappointments when sometime later, after we got the station going, he moved off to become the director of cinema, the Cinema Institute for Indiana University, and has had a fascinating career ever since. And we're going to be talking about with him about his career, his life, but also about movies. Movies. What are they? Where do they come from? What's the big attraction? All of these things are fascinating to those of us who either watch them on television or go to the theater or see them on our computer or whatever. So John's going to tell us everything there is to know about movies. John, how are you today?
I'm doing well, John. It's really good to be with you on the station again.
Well, it is fun to have you because what I will start right off by saying is that when I was a newbie, I had never done a radio show in my life, and I didn't know anything about computers, and John walked me through sometimes in the wee hours of the morning, bless his soul, until finally John said after about the third time that I kept him from getting to bed, he said, John, now you can do this on your own. And I felt, OMG, I'm on. That was a kiss-off message. I've got to do this on my own. And it's worked, okay? It's worked. Sometimes with little glitches, but for the most part, it's worked. And I owe that to John. So, John.
Well, I don't know if you owe that to me, but thank you. And let me just make one correction about the founder of the radio station. It really, as you know, those early days, everybody was working hard to make it happen. And none of us, you know, knew what we were doing, but we had a vision. And I'm so glad that we were able to get on the air in 2006.
Well, and the station is still going, and it is unique, probably, in many low-power stations, in that it has a large percentage the product that it puts out over the air is generated by the local folks, the local people, and it's music and it's public affairs and discussion and so on, and poetry. All of these things are in that particular station. They do a great job. Very interesting place to work and a lot of interesting people to work with.
Yes.
John, where are you from originally?
So I grew up in actually a small town in Indiana, Coutts, Indiana, until 1970, and our family then moved to Southwest Michigan, Lakeside, in 1970. My father was an engineer, and he had an idea for some patents for some packaging equipment that he wanted to develop, so he started a small machine shop, and that led to a job shop, which fed our family for many years. And the business that my brothers and I eventually went into with my father and mother. So, yes, it started out in Indiana, then back into Michigan, and then now back to Indiana.
How did you get back to Indiana? Now, you started off with a family that had a business in Three Oaks or near Three Oaks.
Yes.
And where did you go to school?
I went to Michigan State, got a civil engineering degree, and had no real intention of coming back to Southwest Michigan. I wanted to go to California and build bridges. I was really fascinated with what my father was doing in Three Oaks. He was building some special equipment. And I just thought at the time when I graduated, if I don't come back and learn from this guy, I would be stupid. And so I did. And my brothers and I started working towards taking over the family business from my father. Unfortunately, this was 1987. He retired in 88, 89, got sick, and then eventually died in early 1991. So he didn't have much of a retirement, but I was able to learn quite a bit from him. And in hindsight, of course, you know, that was the best decision I ever made. After coming back to the family business, doing that, my brothers and I were running Vickers Engineering, and it continued to grow into a really healthy job shop and production shop. But along the way, I found my accidental career, which was really the love of movies. And Jennifer, my wife, and I ended up buying the Vickers Theater, which was the Lee Theater at the time, in Three Oaks, Michigan, in 1993. It had been closed, I think, since 1986. And we had this vision of showing interesting movies and living in the old projection booth and living a bohemian lifestyle, showing art films. And it didn't quite work out that way, but it did work out well.
You had a theater already ready made. This, how long had that theater, that physical building, been there?
Yeah, it was built as a livery in the 1890s and then converted to a movie theater in 1911. And it ran as a movie theater off and on again until about 1986. It changed names and changed hands several times. But the main core owners of the theater were the Lees, and they ran the Lee Theater for decades. But when we bought it in 1986, when we bought it in 1993, it had already been converted into office space and then living space. And so it really didn't resemble a theater anymore. So we had to bring it back to become a theater.
How long did it take you to do that? Was it your own hands, or did you have other people helping you?
It was a mix. Yeah, I would say we did about 60 to 70% of the work on, maybe even 80% of the work on the theater. But we had local contractors. A local gentleman named Cat Trucks did a lot of the work with us. We had a local welding shop. And then eventually we were able to brick the outside with local masons, including Cat Trucks and Dick Bursma. So it was ourselves. We did the design with some help from friends in Benton Harbor, IN Design, and they were friends because they were patrons of the cinema after we had opened. It was a mix, but we did the majority of the work ourselves, and it took us about 2.5 years.
Why a theater? I mean, you were the head of Vickers Engineering with your brothers, but the Vickers Theater, why movies? Why did you get into movies?
I was known in Three Oaks at the video stores as the guy who liked the weird movies. And so, you know, anything that was foreign language or independent or quirky, I guess it was considered weird at the local video stores. And so, yes, I did have a love of movies. I was introduced to foreign films at Michigan State in a small theater called the Odeon. I liked classic and independent and foreign language films. And Jennifer and I would drive to Chicago to see movies. So we would go to the Fine Arts Theater or the Music Box or the Gene Siskel Film Center in Chicago to see movies. And, you know, the idea at first was, why don't we bring those here to our community? It's selfishly for ourselves, but then hopefully others would like them as well.
What attracted you to movies generally? Now, you said that you're interested in foreign films and art films, but first of all, we're going to get into some definitions here in a minute, but
yeah.
What attracted you to not the big box office pictures, perhaps, more than what you did watch, which are these indies and foreign films?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I think, I mean, I like both. I like to be entertained. I like, action movies. I like, all kinds of genre movies, horror movies. So I like that as well. But I also like the personal stories. I like stories that might seem slow to people, but might really be in real time. And I like movies that take their time. I like movies that feel very naturalistic. I like to feel like I'm getting an experience of another person or another culture. And I mean, I you asked the question, why movies? And, I think, well, first off, I think the arts help us, intellectually, physically, emotionally, cope with the ever-changing trials of the human condition. And speak about trials of the human condition right now, in the last year or two, we've gone through several. But cinema is really, I think, the most accessible of the art forms. It has this ability to build empathy. You can feel like you're walking in somebody else's shoes. And it helps you transcend borders, cultures, languages, class divides, even generations, and find, if you're lucky, some universal truths. I mean, feel connected, with other parts of the world in this way. And I think, part of the reason for the Vickers Theater is, mainstream media doesn't necessarily do a good job of depicting the lives of other cultures or the lives of the people in other cultures. And these small movies from those cultures do. And so, that was part of the reason. Empathy is a big, big part of it. And the late Roger Ebert, who we all know was a great Harbor Country citizen and a real supporter of the Vickers Theater, noted that, empathy is the most essential quality of a civilization. He called movies empathy machines. And so, I believe that. I wholeheartedly believe that. And I think that's kind of what drove us, partially at least, to do this. And again, there was this selfish desire just to show things that we want to see. But we also wanted to, share with a community. We wanted to build community. I think those are some of the reasons we need movies. And those are some of the reasons, we opened the Vickers Theater.
All right. Two questions. One is, pardon me, when you first started this, you had put your own money into this, and I take it, and your own sweat labor. And so my question is, did it ever become profitable? Did people ever want to come to see these movies that you so loved?
Absolutely. Now let's use the word profit with, quotation marks or air quotes around it, say. Jennifer and I never took a salary out of the Vickers Theater. We paid ourselves rent. We didn't have a mortgage. We were able to, do the build out of the theater from our savings. I always thought that if we could, be as frugal as possible and put our own sweat equity into it, as long as we controlled how much cash or capital we were putting into the theater, knowing that we would someday be able to get that out of it, we would have a good investment. But all of our time that we dedicated to it was, we considered our hobby. I mean, most people's hobbies cost them money. Ours didn't. I mean, we were getting to meet great people, show movies, entertain people, have this amazing social experience and build some of the best friendships we've ever had with this community that we brought to the theater. And it didn't cost us money, but it actually made a little bit of money. I mean, it made enough to pay, again, say a car payment or, whatever the expenses that you might share a little bit between a business and the proprietor, as well as, it paid the rent. And so, we were really happy with the meager profit we were making, but we were making a profit by our second or third year all, and then the Browning Cinema. And I was the first director of the Browning Cinema. I'll tell you that when I took that job and I started receiving a salary from the University of Notre Dame, I did feel guilty about taking money for something that I love to do. I did not think it was a career. I just thought that I was in this lucky spot at the right time. And, I almost couldn't believe it was true. And I worked hard, to build this program there. And we built a really strong film program at the University of Notre Dame. But that was my stop. 2006 to 2010, I was running this cinema. And eventually, was the managing director of the Performing Arts Center as well. So I've had my hands in many other aspects of the center. In 2009, I was approached to throw my hat in the ring for this new position at Indiana University. They were building a cinema, and I was asked to interview for the position, and I did. And I realized that this was going to be something special. The president of the university was behind it, who was a cinephile. He loved movies. They were trying to make the facility one of the best in the country, and they really had ambitions of making the program one of the best in the country. And I was asked to go through this process. I did. I was one of the final four candidates, and I was up against three PhDs in film studies and me with a civil engineering degree in manufacturing experience, got the job. And I was thrilled. I sometimes, many times along the way, I felt like I still wasn't qualified, even though I knew I could open the cinema and do a great job. But we ended up building, you know, a pretty amazing program. The facility is considered one of the best in the country. I'm the founding director of Indiana University Cinema. In our first 10 years of being open, we opened in January of 2011. We screened over 2,200 unique film titles. We had over 3,000 public events. We hosted more than 300 visiting filmmakers, issued about 325,000 tickets, with half of those being free to the public, which we calculated having a market value of like $1.6 million. We collaborated on about 40% of our program with academic departments around campus and into the community. So it became a really deeply embedded academic movie theater that, you know, reached deep across the campus into the schools, into the departments, into the, you know, different units. And, you know, we would have partner programs on any topic that you can imagine. We would bring filmmakers in to, you know, talk to students, but also present their work in the cinema on a very regular basis. And it's, you know, it's a program that I'm really proud of. I would say, you know, other than my family, it's one of, you know, my proudest accomplishments, you know, building this institution from scratch. And of course, you know, we built a really great team around us. And so we had, you know, so many talented professionals working with us. So it's not just me, but it was really great to lead that vision and build something special. We've had so many filmmakers, you know, comment on the facility, never seeing their films presented like they had in our place, you know, even at their premieres at Cannes or Sundance or wherever they may be. We've had, you know, filmmakers talk about the breadth of the program rivaling the best cinematheques in the world. And yeah, we've had some really, really prominent people say nice things about what we've done, and it really feels good to have accomplished that.
We're going to come back to this in a minute, but I'd like to help people like myself understand what movies are about and what are they, and how do they get made, and you know, when you go to a movie and you see the credits after the movie, some they have gotten so large in terms of the number of people that are listed and the various things that they do that it boggles the mind that it takes so many people to make a modern movie. But let me go back to how it got started. When did movies start?
Yeah, well, I mean, the two leading figures, you know, for the, you know, the beginning of movies were Thomas Edison and the Lumiere brothers from Paris. And both of them were really discovering film and the process of shooting film in a moving picture way in the 1890s. And so, you know, they were at the forefront, and there were others. There were actually many things that led up to it. There were, you know, series of still images in like rotoscopes or vitascopes or other ways of manipulating single images to give an impression of motion. And a lot of those types of machines were in arcades where you would, you know, put a penny in and you'd do a hand crank and you'd get to see a series of images flip like a flip book, but it would look like a, you know, a moving image. And so, you know, there were a lot of precursors to cinema, but real movies caught with a camera and projected, you know, with light onto a screen really started with Thomas Edison and the Lumiere brothers. And they were the ones who, you know, really continued to push the, the technology that they want to be able to, you know, be able to do more with a movie camera and capture more of real life scenes. And it's, you know, and then eventually they start telling stories. But I mean, really, they were initially for capturing everyday life. I mean, they were early documentaries. They were early short slices of life segments, whether it be a boxing match or a kiss or a train coming into a station. I mean, the early films were just capturing everyday life. But then, of course, then they started changing to where they were being directed, and they were, you know, there were stories being told and narratives, and you know, so many players that it's impossible to in a short program to talk about. But really, it started with the Lumieres and Thomas Edison.
There's, I've loved movies. I've loved all different kinds of movies. In fact, my daughter teases me when I try to get her to watch a black and white film. It's, you know, oh, Dad, that's, you know, that's ancient. Well, at one point when it all started with the storytelling as well as recording of daily life, it was all black and white and, in fact, had no sound to it, right?
Right. Well, you know, that's it's true that, you know, all early movies were captured without sound or without color. But then a lot of the early films, even from, you know, before the teens, like 1905, 1906, I'm not sure when the first tinted or the first hand-colored films came into play, but early silent films did have color that was added after the fact. And a prominent film magician, Georges Méliès, hand-colored a lot of his own films to where there's these brilliant colors coming through, but it was all hand-done. Hmm. And then, you know, famed film organists or composers, you know, argue that the films were never silent. Even though they were captured silent, you know, they were always presented with some kind of accompaniment. Even in Three Oaks at the Fairyland Theater, which was, you know, our theater, but the theater that it originally opened as in 1911, the Fairyland Theater had silent movies in 1911, but they weren't silent because they had a pianist in there, you know, playing piano, or they might have a small band. In fact, many of the ancestors of the Lees played instruments, you know, to back up the movies. And so the silent films, you know, yes, were captured silently and it's projected silently, but there was always something there to accompany it when they were presented to an audience. And when I say always, that's probably not true, but the majority of the time they were not silent.
One of the movies, the two movies that I remember hearing about and seeing, actually, at least parts of them, there was a movie called The General, which apparently had some place in movie history. And also, of course, Birth of a Nation is another D.W. Griffith movie, which has now gone out of favor. But back in the 20s, I guess it was, both of those films were very good. I mean, they were a big thing.
Yeah, and many, many others. The General is you know, one of the it's one of the pillars of silent comedy for sure. And Buster Keaton plays the General. That film has continued to entertain audiences even today, and we've screened the General at the Vickers Theater. We've screened it at Indiana University with live music. I mean, those films still really pack a punch. Now, you talk about Birth of a Nation, and of course it is controversial for the racism. And for those in the audience who don't know the controversy, D.W. Griffith, used film language to, you know, get the audience to root for the Klan. The Klan is the savior, you know, the saviors in the end of the film. And, you know, not only, the film language is really where it goes and how it becomes that way, where you build this, you know, great triumphant, you know, rescue, and the way the editing's done and the way the tension builds, it's all done to, you know, favor the Klan. And you know, it was racist at the time. It's racist now. You know, many people believe that film should never be shown. I think there's great academic value in watching the film and understanding how images can lie to you, and you know, how images can manipulate you. And, you know, there are good lessons that are still valuable today, you know, in mainstream media, because, you know, we all know that images can manipulate, and they still are manipulating us today.
This is a good segue point. We're going to come back and talk just about this particular issue of how movies can affect society in ways that the viewers may not even pay attention to or may not even consciously think of. But we'll get back to that in just a minute. We're talking to John Vickers, who is the director, was until recently the director of the Indiana University Cinema program, and well known in our area for his work with not only the Vickers Engineering, but also the Vickers Theater and our radio station that was started down there, WRHC. We're going to be talking to him more about this, the power of the movie, in just a minute. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. Back on With Respect with John Vickers, originally from Indiana, then back to Michigan, then to Indiana, and God knows where else he'll be going. But, John, when we broke, you had talked about the value of seeing a movie which goes beyond necessarily the propriety of that movie, whether it fits into the accepted mores or culture of a particular time. How do you explain that? I mean, it does. Movies do have an effect on people that they don't even think about, don't they?
Oh, they do, certainly. And cinema is a language. Cinema is a language just like any other language. And there are tools to make the person receiving, you know, what you're putting in front of them, think in one way or think in another way. And some examples, it could be lighting. The way a person is lit can affect their prominence in your mind while you're watching a film, or the camera angle. If you're looking down on a person versus looking up at a person, it may subconsciously give you the idea of strength or weakness. And so there are many tools within the handbag of movie making and cinema language that directors can use to make you feel a certain way. Color is another you know, good example of the you know, the cold of blue, or the anger or the tension of a red. And so there are many ways that, you know, directors use this language to try to get you to feel a certain way. And it isn't necessarily deceptive in a way that's, most filmmakers don't have an agenda necessarily, other than trying to get you to feel a way for an effect of a film. So most filmmakers aren't using it in a way that's going to maybe change you politically, but they are trying to play with your emotions, and they are trying to get you to feel certain things and think certain things when they're showing you the story that they're telling. And so it's really no different than the media today in many other forms, whether it's the news, whether it's a propagandic, whether it's propaganda or whether it's, TV commercials trying to sell you something, they're all using the language to, again, manipulate you. It's similar to the way, women are portrayed often unflatteringly or as sexualized with the male gaze, in the way they're positioned, the way they're lit, and the way they're dressed, the way they're poised. These are all ways to manipulate a viewer, whether it's, they're selling something or not. There are just many ways that images, work to get you to feel a certain way. And the more you could know, the more you could learn about that, the better you would be to be able to understand that language and understand when somebody's presenting you that something that they're trying to convince you to do one thing or another. And I'm not articulating this that well, but I do think that there's real value in young people learning film literacy or moving image literacy, because it's a language that's being used more and more. And, we're on our phones or in front of screens more than we ever were before in our lives. And that's all visual language.
Well, what you're talking about, I think, is I'm taking out of it is that the more education that people have about this particular medium, the more they can, appreciate what the artist or the creator of this movie was trying to do, but also can look at how they play on your heartstrings or want to be entertained. Now, that's an important word in my next question. You've talked about cinema being an art form, but it's also entertainment.
Sure.
And there is a radical difference between the two aspects of movies. Would you agree or correct me?
Yeah, I think, absolutely. I mean, when I am going to a movie, I think I know to some degree which of those, if we're going to categorize in those two categories, whether it's going to be just a pure entertainment or whether I might get something of real value out of it. And I think for me, I love both. I think the more artful movies are more personal. And again, I think I talked about universal truths and empathy, and I want to feel something for the characters. I want to feel moved, and I want to maybe be changed in some way. And I think a good piece of art has the ability to change you in some way, whether it's a painting, whether it's music.
Let me interject something in here.
Sure.
As an example of what you're saying, I ran for public office on a number of occasions, and sometimes you would get really beaten down, and you come home, you're exhausted, and people have been pounding on you, and you wonder, why am I doing this? Why am I taking this? Why am I driving 175,000 miles in a year to get myself out there and let the public see who I am and either vote me up or down? But I remember I found myself, when I got in the lowest point, I would sit down and watch Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And that movie was Jimmy Stewart and was it Myrna Loy, or I can't remember the actress. But that was about a simple guy went down to Washington in strange circumstances just to do a good job and be a good citizen. And he got caught up in politics that were pretty brutal. And the famous ending of the movie was when he conducted a filibuster on the floor of the Senate, and his ability to stand for hours and hours and hours speaking, so he had the floor. And the bad guy could not get the floor from him so long as he could stand. And he stood until finally his exhaustion was so great that he literally collapsed on the floor. Yeah. And then people should watch this movie, and I won't, I'm not going to give the ending, but it's a real powerful ending.
Yeah.
That movie was not well received when it first was aired, as I understand it, in Washington. He didn't like the image of politicians that was showing. But yeah. It got me going. I mean, the next day, I could get up out of bed and do another 300 miles of driving and take the Slings and Arrows of Outrageous Fortune. That movie affected my life.
Yeah, I agreed. I mean, there are movies where, you know, I think I'll never forget a scene, or I'll never forget how I felt, you know, coming out of a film. And I agree with that. And they can be inspiring. They can be a lot of things. And I don't know if I expect that if I'm going in to see an action film, but there are times when I want to see an action film or whatever it might be. So, yeah, I think there's room for both. And I hope that, well, part of the hope with the Vickers Theater and part of the hope of, you know, doing what I've been doing for the past 27 years is that people take a chance, even though they don't know that type of cinema, they've never seen a small personal film or they've never seen a foreign language film. They take a chance on something and they try it because you never know how you're going to be changed. And you know, that's, for me, the power is in those, you know, those smaller films and smaller stories. But I, you know, I've also been moved in big movies too. So, yeah, I don't know. I think if it's done well, the director does their job well, and they create some art, even in a big blockbuster commercial film that's designed to make hundreds of millions of dollars, there's still art in those films too, no question. And I have different expectations when I go to them.
In post-COVID, post our pandemic, and the run-up to it, I perceive, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on, I perceive that movies have changed in so many different ways than it was 5 or 10 years before we were all went into quarantine and entertainment was watching Netflix on television.
Yeah.
But now we're in an era where COVID is gone or going, and are people going back to the theaters, or are we so stuck in what happened for a year or so that, it'll never be the same? I remember saying this to people in all different professions who would say to me, John, the practice of law will never be the same. John, art will never be the same. John, movies will never be the same, and so on. And it's like it's a watershed moment in families and in businesses and in certainly restaurants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What about this? Are we going to go back? Can we ever go back to the world of everybody going in on a Saturday afternoon or Friday evening or Saturday evening to watch a movie? Are we going to go back to that, or is it gone?
I don't think it's gone. I think that there's always going to be a desire for this shared experience. You know, we see concerts coming back. We see big sporting events coming back. You know, people want to be in this communal environment to experience something together. And I think in movies, it may take longer than in other venues. We have a venue opening up in Indianapolis, which I'm on the board of, and it's an art cinema with a restaurant, and it's opening tomorrow night. I'll be there. It's called the Can Can Cinema and Brasserie in Indianapolis, and they were set to open in March of 2020, just before everything closed. And they're super enthusiastic. Their membership has grown over during COVID in anticipation of them opening. There's been so many signs that their base that they didn't even have is there, and they're anxious and hungry and ready to go back to the movies. And I hope that's really the case. But I think there's, for art cinema, the core audience is usually like a 50 plus in age. And so I think there's going to be a little more patience in going back to normal, of an older audience. But I still think that, people are going to be hungry for this experience. I mean, there's nothing like a movie on a movie screen compared to on your screen at home. And let me just say that I also think there's going to be, especially in smaller theaters and independent theaters, there's going to be some kind of a hybrid. So I think theaters are going to continue to try to show things virtually as well as in person to make sure that they're satisfying both audiences, the audience that's not ready to come back plus the audience that is ready to come back. And we see that with IU Cinema opening up this fall. There's going to be virtual experiences as well. So I truly believe it's going to come back. And it may take more time than needed, but I do believe it's coming back.
We're going to take a break now. We're talking to John Vickers, the founder of the Indiana University Cinema Program Institute, whatever its formal title is. He's been talking about movies and where it's been and maybe where we're going. We have another whole bunch of other things to talk about, and we will when we get back in just a moment. This is John Smetanka and With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with the director, the creator of the Cinema Institute at Indiana University. And John Vickers, who started that program, has been helping us walk through where it is that we have been going, where we started, in the broad swaths of where we are and where we're going. But I want to take another step and talk about how we go about making the modern movie and the tremendous amount of money and resources going in to make some of the big box office pictures. This is John Smetanka. So, John, I go to movies. I watch movies. I love movies. Back in the day, they would even be first date movies. I was dating somebody, and let's go to the show. Let's go to the movies, and that was kind of just an accepted thing. And I made one really bad decision once. I had a nice, I was fixed up with a nice young doctor, and I took her to, of all things, Jurassic Park for first date. And one of my friends, my friend who fixed us up, said, John, Jurassic Park is not a first date movie. Where is your brains? Get a romance. Anyway, I watch these movies, and in the big screens, in the theaters, they will allow you to see all the trailers, the credits at the end of the movie. And it seems like in some of these movies, it's hundreds of people having different roles. And we loosely give credits to actors, directors, producers, And then after that, you begin to say, well, wait a minute, who are all these people? The one I get a charge out of is the best boy. Mm-hmm. Oh, what the heck is a best boy? But there's so many people that are involved in making one of these. It's got to be extraordinarily expensive to make a movie for general circulation. Yes?
Yeah. Well, especially, you know, an action movie or a science fiction movie or, say, a Marvel movie, you know, there is so much CGI, so much animation, so, you know, much after effects that really incorporates probably the majority of the names that you're seeing on screen. Mm-hmm. You know, you could still go to a small independent movie and have less than 100 people in the credits. So I mean, really, John, it, you know, it depends on the movie, but you're right. In the big commercial movies, it's thousands of people. You know, what really is driving the big studios, they need to have major tentpole successes. By the time they're going to make a $100 million movie, they are going to also have, say, $30 million and you know, print and advertising. And so, you know, they need to recoup a lot, you know, and a $200 million movie is maybe $60 million in print and advertising. And so the studios are kind of caught in the middle of not taking chances on smaller budget movies and trying to find the right, you know, gambling on the right tentpole movies to kind of pull them through. So in many ways, there are less movies being made because a lot of the funding is going into these major movies, and there are less movies in the middle arena being made. Now, I will say that there are still many independent movies that are, you know, micro budget or, you know, $5 million and below, that are finding their finances other ways outside of the studios. And those are the films that you might consider perhaps more artistic or more artistically driven or more writer-director driven, where the director has a vision and wants to see it through and is able to find the finances to make the film. Unfortunately, in the U.S., we don't have any film funds, say, to back filmmakers like we see in Europe and other places where there are funds available from the government to, you know, help tell these artistic stories. But independent filmmakers are finding their way, and they're finding their ways to get their films made. They're finding their ways to get their films seen. So there's a lot more than, you know, just the big commercial films. But the commercial films are absolutely finance-driven, profit-driven. There's artistry in it, certainly. But, you know, the studios need to make money.
Well, that's like art of any kind, I think, that you can have the greatest artist produce magnificent canvases, but if no one looks at them,
yeah,
no one sees them, or if they don't meet the taste of the people of the day, right, in a large enough spread of those people, then it's, you know, then they go into the attic of someone's house, and then all of a sudden they find out 50 or 100 years later, oh, that guy was really popular. Now let's cash in on it, what we found in our attic. But it doesn't. I think the same thing has got to be true with movies. How do they find out what is going to sell? What is going to be profitable? I know, for example, art galleries. You find a museum or an art gallery where you can go in and see a wide range of works of particular various artists. If it's an art gallery, you can buy the product. But the question is, even the art gallery and the museum people have to be discriminate as far as what is going to bring people in, what is going to help even just to look around, I would think. Same thing I'd look with movies.
Yeah, well, certainly. And, you know, that's the big question for producers and studio heads. But, I mean, that's also one of the reasons you see so many sequels, prequels, reboots. I mean, telling a story that, you know, was big in the 80s or 90s and rebooting it. And, you know, so you that makes up a pretty healthy percentage of the market. And, you know, and once you get a franchise going, you know, you believe that you can continue to make money on that franchise. So that's, you know, that's unfortunately where a lot of the studio decisions are made. But I, you know, I don't know if I can really answer, you know, how the markets is determined or how, you know, what tools they use, John.
Well, even if you can't figure out how it is determined, I think you could agree that people's tastes change from decade to decade. People's tastes change from amount of money that they have to shell out for a movie, what they're going to spend. There's got to be some touching of the soul, and souls keep changing. Society's souls keep changing. At any rate,
yes.
You talked about producers and directors, and I've always been fascinated. I think I understand what a director is. I've seen enough images and where they stand with a microphone and said, "All right, let's start, roll them."
Sure.
But then I've never quite understand about this producer business. What is a producer?
Yeah, well, you know, many producers make sure that the train stays on the tracks. You know, there are many different levels of producers. Like many executive producers, sometimes bring something to the table, whether it's bringing the property to the table. When I say property, maybe it's bringing the story to the table, or maybe it's bringing influence or name or other things that are going to help the film along. Producers also bring money. Producers find money. But also producers, you know, keep the show moving forward, keep the director in line. If there's 27 days of shooting, making sure that the director is on schedule. But the director really has been carrying the vision, working with the actors, working with the cinematographer, you know, probably working in the editing room, working with the composer. So the director usually is the one who has the vision to tell the story. But the producer then often helps keep the director in line and keep things moving forward. That's a very simple breakdown, but that's, you know, that's kind of how it works.
If you were to get into the movies, and by the way, there's so much to talk about. I'd like to have you come back on another occasion to talk more about your future plans and your vision of the future. But I'd like to finish up this segment by just touching on what is it that you think, where do you think movies are going to be going? Now, let me say what I mean by that. All right, you've got documentaries, you've got dramas, comedies, you've got cable television, you've got streaming, and you've got art theaters and big theaters and so on. You've got Harry Potter with, you know, unending series, and Star Wars just keep spinning and spinning and spinning out. Where's it going to go, John? And you've only got 3 minutes to tell me.
Well, I mean, I think we've seen some of the writing on the wall already, and some of the biggest content producers, and we'll call them studios now, are Netflix and Amazon. And I mean, the streaming services have the budgets to produce major motion pictures. They're winning Oscars, so they're becoming real studios, and they have the mechanism to then promote their work and show their work and sell their work. And so I think you're going to continue to see the streaming services continue to thrive, continue to support good artistic visions and great directors. We've seen many, many prominent filmmakers do things for Amazon and Netflix. And so I think you'll continue to see that line, go strong. But I think episodic television will continue to go strong as well, which you can argue whether that's movies or not. But I still believe, really, with all of my heart, that smaller films are going to be made by filmmakers without a lot of money, and they're going to continue to find audiences for their films through film festivals and other means, and then through streaming. But I think storytellers are going to continue to thrive and make work, in many ways, it's much easier to make the work, maybe harder to get it seen. But I think this, I think storytelling is going to live strong and continue. And I think, you know, as audiences, we're going to have ultimate options, and we already have too many options to you know, too many things to see. But I think there will continue to be places like small cinemas that curate for you and put things in front of you that they believe is worth seeing.
John Vickers, our friend, you've been very interesting talking to you today. And I'd like you to come back, if you would, because there's a whole bunch of other things we can talk about your life and movies and where things are going. But unfortunately, we're out of time. So sure. Thanks very much for joining us today. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect. And the name of our program tries to show what we're trying to show, to do. And that is show respect and to people that have accomplished things and we can learn from. Our program is on every Sunday and Thursday. Remember our motto? Until next time, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.